This episode of This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you exclusively by Axia Audio, featuring low-latency live wire audio over IP, now in use at over 2,000 radio, TV, and production studios, on the web at axiaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twirt. That was a great show. Great show.
That was awesome, Greg. That was really great.
That was excellent.
You know, it's really good having a guest who's smarter than us.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
Hold on to your hat. As promised, Greg Oganowski joins us, along with Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hello there. I'm Kirk Harnack, and very glad that you have joined us. You've tuned in to the show that talks about radio technology, and that really, that includes a lot of things nowadays. Everything from the microphone to the, there's still a few styli on turntables, audio consoles, audio mixing, routing technologies, audio processing technologies, studio to transmitter link technology, and transmission technology. And that's just the terrestrial part of it. We also end up talking about things like audio streaming and how to get your metadata in there, how to get your audio to sound great on one of Greg Oganowski's applications. And I'll introduce our guest here in just a minute. But first, let's hit our co-hosts. Along with us, the best-dressed engineer in radio from Manhattan, New York City, it's Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. Tell us about what you do and why you're qualified to ask Greg a question.
Let's see. I'm currently employed by the CBS Radio Group here in New York City. We've got 6 radio stations, 27 streams of audio, 18 HD channels, and what else? And 12 hours of video a day. So if that's a qualification, then great. If not, hey, it's just great to be able to talk with Greg. And he's well known in the industry for a lot of success stories. So
As you pointed out, in CBS in New York, you've got more video coming out of there than most TV stations do.
Yes, we do. We're up to, I think it's 14 hours of video now, live television. And we'll be adding a few more cameras to the studio complex in the next couple of weeks. So it's just building as we go along. But as broadcast technologist at CBS here in New York, I'm just looking at all the different technologies, try to find ways to make money with it and make my job a little easier and those of the jocks and the news folks. So, we have 2 news stations, all news stations, and 1 all sports station, along with the 3 FMs. So it's very busy here in New York.
Chris, let me remind you, we're still expecting a tour.
Yes, I know. Trust me. I've got a few little quirks we got to work past.
That's what you say every week. Hey, and
I have no choice. It's either that or I start fibbing on people, and I can't do that. I just can't, turn people off.
I hear you. Joining us from the nation's midsection in snowy, cold Wisconsin, from Muckwonago, Wisconsin, it's Chris Tarr. Hello, Chris.
Hi there. You don't happen to have any Wisconsin senators hiding down there, do you? We're missing a couple. I was just checking. Yes, I am the director of engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So there are 5 FMs and 1 AM. And basically, if it's got electricity going through it, I take care of it.
And I visited you, of course, last week. We did this show from your studios there last week. And listen, thanks for bending over backwards and getting, internet and power to my laptop and making the thing look good. But you've got an expansion project coming up. I don't know if you're free to talk about it. And this is not the right show to do that tonight. But in some plan, an expansion of your radio station facilities, that's got to take, a lot of planning for it to come off well.
It's a little premature yet. We haven't gotten down to that stage yet. We are exploring it, however.
All right. Enough said about that then. Well, let me introduce our guest for this evening. I'd met with Greg Oganowski at last September's AES convention in San Francisco, back when we did the show live from Petaluma's studios back then in September. I've met Greg some years ago, about 5-6 years ago. I think Greg and I ended up meeting at a podcasting convention in the Inland Empire of California. And Greg introduced me to the most fascinating thing. I'd heard about streaming to cell phones, but I never heard it before. And Greg, you showed me, there he is. Greg, you showed me a cell phone and you flipped it open and you punched a couple buttons. And all of a sudden we were hearing, I think it was it KFI?
It was KFI, as a matter of fact.
That's there was an interesting little story. First off, before we get going here, I want to get a few thank yous out of the way first. Sure. One, Kirk, thank you very much for the invitation here. And Chris, thank you for your support with all that Orban Optimod stuff over there at the big CBS. Go ahead, Kirk.
Oh, you're welcome.
So I was just going to mention that that podcasting show that you and I met at in Riverside or Ontario or wherever that was at the time, it was right when HD radio was it was sort of like up for experimental, and the Clear Channel stations had I think they had the KFI audio up on KISS, so that was my STL. I brought the KFI audio over here to Diamond Bar, which is a suburb east of LA. That's where my office is currently. And we brought that in here and then streamed it to the internet. And knowing that Leo Laporte was going to be on that show, and he was going to be doing it live from the convention center, wherever that was. I don't even remember exactly where that was, but I think it was Pomona Fairgrounds. Maybe that's where it was.
Was it? Oh gosh, the town has the same name. It's another town that I want to say Oakland, but that's not Oakland.
No,
Oakland.
Ontario.
Ontario, that's it. Ontario, California.
Yeah, it was the podcasting show in Ontario, California. Then,
yeah.
Okay. All right, because I seem to remember meeting up with Leo Laporte a couple of times.
His weekend show live from there. In fact, his engineer had a problem with an old black-faced Zephyr at the show, and so I happened to have a Zephyr Extreme with me from Telos, and I said, here, borrow it. And they borrowed the Zephyr Extreme and ended up doing the show with the borrowed Zephyr Extreme.
I thought you were going to say you happened to have a spare tube with you. I remember showing that to you, and I remember holding the phone up for Leo, because it was the first time he'd ever seen or heard anything like that as well. That goes back to we originally started showing this stuff around 2004, because let me give you guys a very brief history here. I had been, I'll keep this as brief as possible, because we literally could go on here for a week with this stuff. But briefly, I had been a consultant to Orban for a good many years, more years than any of us ever want to think that we've even been in this business together. But it hasn't been until the last 10 or 11 years that I have been officially employed by them, capacity of VP product development. When I did this deal and put this together with them, one of the things that I had talked to Bob and Jay about was the fact that I really wanted to work on improving the audio over the internet, because I really saw this as the future. I mean, we're going on 10 years, and here we are 10 years later, and it's finally starting to all come to pass. But I was warned that this was going to take a very long time, and I didn't believe anybody, but boy, they sure were right. One thing I've learned from this experience is it's very, very difficult to change the world anymore. I remember the days when we'd come up with a new audio processor. I'd spend a couple of months or whatever working on the thing, throw a prototype together in my trunk and take it up to my buddies in LA, and we'd have it on the air that afternoon, and everybody was impressed, and we'd end up with something that would make history. Today, we have to have a meeting after a meeting after a meeting just to decide if it's okay to test it. But that's another story.
Yeah.
Somewhere around 2002, I was walking around an AES in LA, and I ran into this little company called Coding Technologies. And I was on a quest to look for a codec that was better than the real codecs at the time, or certainly the dreadful Microsoft codecs.
Yeah.
Because these guys were just not going to cut it if we wanted to look at improving the internet. It was going to take more than just audio processing, because these codecs, in my opinion, just sounded dreadful. Simply put, I put the headphones on to their demo, and I don't think I had them on for about 10 seconds, and I lifted up the one earpiece, and I said to this guy there from coding, his name was Andreas, and I said, Andreas, what bit rate is this? And he says, 32 kilobits. I said, Andreas, I said, I've heard enough. I said, when you get back to Germany, I said, we don't have time to talk about this. I said, prepare the paperwork. It's sold. And he looks at me with a smile and he goes, really? He says, what are you going to do with this? I said, Andreas, I'm going to put this on the internet. So this has been a really, really long battle to get HEAAC is what this the name of this codec was. Yep. It's been a long battle to get everybody to see it this way. But I can finally say that Adobe Flash has picked it up. Microsoft has picked it up for Windows 7. Apple has picked it up for the entire iPhone and iTunes ecosystem. And away we go. It's HEAAC is finally displacing WMA and MP3. So with that said, we now have the transmission path fixed, and we only have to concentrate our efforts on feeding the machine with a good source, because it still starts with the source. All the audio still starts with the source. And going into a decent audio processor, of which there are several to choose from these days, in various forms, and then going into a full-featured internet streaming encoder, of which I'm proud to say that we probably have the fullest feature encoder available in the Orban OptiCodec PC, supporting just about every single streaming transport and protocol that you could shove HEAAC into. We did. So I'll take a break right now. And
yeah. So I'll tell you what, let's kind of lay out how the next 50 minutes are going to go, Greg, because you've got a lot of information that you could help engineers to understand. And of course, one of your expertises here is audio processing for a bit rate reduced transmission path. And I wonder if you might take a few minutes to tell us, you know, some of the fundamental tenets that you have discovered or that you found to be true about processing audio for a bit rate reduced transmission scheme. It's different from AM, different from FM, different from TV processing or audio processing. What do you got to do to make the encoder happy?
Okay, well, for one thing, it's not too terribly dissimilar. In essence, it's exactly the same thing as what we do for HD radio or any other digital system. The HD radio codec is very closely related to HEAAC, although it is not the same and it is not as good. It's one of the little things that I'm a little bit miffed about, that the folks behind HD radio would not, for whatever reason, they just didn't want to do HEAAC. I don't want to get into those politics, because all I'm going to end up doing is getting in more trouble than I could possibly imagine. But be that as it may, the HEAAC is pretty much the king of the hill in terms of audio codecs these days. It is the most advanced, the best sounding audio codec available with today's technology. Now, putting this in very, very simple terms, there are essentially two ways to get ultra-low bitrate coded audio. One way is to simply divide the audio into several filter banks, do an analysis. I'm really oversimplifying this, mind you. Do an analysis and have this algorithm decide what our ears can live without. Various forms of this have all taken place, starting from MPEG-1, layer 2, then going into layer 3. Microsoft gave their stab at it. Ogg Vorbis gave their stab at it. And then, contrary to popular belief, when AAC came out, everybody thinks that AAC, because Apple was the first to use AAC, they all thought it was the Apple audio codec. Not true. It's the advanced audio codec, and certainly you guys over at Telos know all about this. Then, going back just a little bit to the days of MP3 and WMA, because that's pretty much one if you take those codecs and try to push them down to 32 kilobits or even 64, there just isn't enough bits to get the job done. And what ends up happening is because the algorithm isn't smart enough and there just aren't enough bits, you end up making sacrifices that you don't want to make. In the case of MP3, you just really throw away too much audio bandwidth. In the case of Windows Media, you pay a huge penalty for the watery effect, and everything starts to sound like either a tunnel or very warbly.
Yeah.
So moving on to the next event with all of this was AAC. And AAC it brings all of the tools that were available in MP3 and all the other MPEG family of codecs to the picture here. And then it was scalable to go to HEAAC V1 and V2, version 1 and version 2. Okay. Now, HEAAC works very fundamentally different. Its main goal in life is to get good-sounding audio below 64 kilobits, which is absolutely mandatory for today's mobile networks. The mobile networks, despite what all the carriers would lead you to believe with every other commercial on TV, which is yet another topic that I have a real pet peeve about, be that as it may, mobile streaming is pretty much limited to 64 kilobits. Apple will not approve an app that uses any more bandwidth than that. Mm-hmm. And even at 64 kilobits on a crowded network, you're not going to get any kind of reliability. So you really need to look at 32 kilobit kind of. And just to give you an oversimplified view of the way HEAAC V1 and V2 work, V1 came first, obviously. HEAAC, thank you very much. There you go. What you see is a core codec, which is the AAC-LC, and SBR, which stands for spectral band replication.
That's and the coding technologies addition to this, right?
That would be correct. The coding technologies guys, by the way, were several of the guys that worked at Fraunhofer Institute at Fraunhofer in Germany, and they went and spun off and did their own thing called Coding Technologies to go do this SBR. And what's interesting, there's sort of a real interesting story here with regard to SBR. A long, long time ago, Bob Orban and John Dell'Antonia, and this is years ago, this may be going on in over 15, maybe pushing 20 years ago, Bob did this product that had this high frequency enhancer algorithm. Well, they actually licensed that algorithm from a guy named Lars, who is the head man over at Coding Technologies, or was before Dolby actually bought Coding Technologies. And as the story goes, it's kind of funny. Lars comes to the United States to do the deal, and he gave Orban a hell of a deal, and he says the only stipulation is he says, I want all the money to be put in the suitcase. And John and Bob looked at him and says, are you nuts? He says, no. He says, this is what I want. He says, if this is what you want, this is what you're going to get. Good luck going through customs. And apparently he knew exactly what he was doing, because nothing ever became of it except his bank account got fatter. But anyway, that's a little side note, little interesting little tidbit. And here we go, 15, 20 years later, doing business with the same folks, only in the digital domain and a completely different deal. HEAAC was developed to address the need of being able to download music files to mobile phones. That's what the deal was. And nobody had ever put it on the internet. We were the very first to license the codec for that. So if anybody hates me for doing that, go ahead and send me all kinds of hate mail. If anybody enjoys what we've done, well, now you know who is behind it. This is how it all happened. And if anybody's seen my article that just appeared in Tech Inc., which I guess is a Radio Inc. publication, they'll understand my motivations for all of this. It all started with Up, Up, and Away by the Fifth Dimension when I was 12 years old. But that's another story. Again, I digress, and We don't need to go down there. Back to HEAAC. With this SBR, it's in essence a synthesis algorithm. It takes its cues from the sub-high-frequency energy that is in the area below 6 kilohertz, and it actually reconstructs the highs on the decode side that would be on the player client. And this is the only method in my professional experience that has been able to achieve low bitrate audio coding without the dreadful, watery, skewy sound that we all know and hate from the previous generation codecs.
So what can you tell me about the challenges, though, of making spectral band replication work so that it doesn't, you know, when I first heard it, I had this imagination that, well, this may sound fake because it's sort of making some fake high end, but it's doing it from the cues from the original audio. So
are there any big drawbacks
to doing this?
Well, there are, like anything else, like any of these ultra low bitrate coding. I mean, like, coding audio, period, is one set of compromises. And it all depends on how far you want to turn those compromises up as to how much damage you're actually going to do. And, you know, audio processing is a set of compromises as well, once again, depending on what your objective is. I like to describe audio processing as describing it as the finishing touches, very analogous to a Hollywood movie. When a Hollywood movie is shot, before it actually goes to the release, every single scene is exposure corrected. It is color corrected. Everything is touched up, and that pretty much what separates the pros from the amateurs. And it's the same sort of thing with audio. It's really kind of a hard thing to explain. Us as broadcasters, we're only sort of in the high fidelity business. We're really in the advertising and the entertainment business, and our job is to give somebody a product that has glitter and sheen and shine to it. It's something that gives the audience something that they can be comfortable to listen to. Remembering that the number one annoyance is always having to adjust the volume or always having to adjust the bass and treble. So it's a consistency thing. And some people like to use audio processing to actually color. And I respect that too. I think high energy top 40 music formats actually benefit from that. That's just my personal opinion. But and then at the same time, you know, relaxing music benefits from very low levels of audio processing because it's an ambience. It's a thing that people are trying to have on in the background to set an environment while they're doing something else.
So let me ask back to the issue of coding, processing audio for coding. Have you found some general rules of thumb that need to be adhered to? And I'm sure Orban has incorporated these into its processing products for coding, just as, you know, the company I work for, Omnia, we have a few ideas of our own about it, what should be done for coding. What have you found?
Absolutely. One of the first things that one has to be very careful of is dealing with the high frequencies, and especially with SBR, since it is a synthesis. It's not manufacturing high end out of the air. As I said, it's taking these cues from the lower frequency area, so it's giving it a very good educational guess as to what needs to happen. Having excessive audio processing where you make the highs real busy is sort of a recipe for disaster for either the SBR-based codecs or even the codecs that don't use SBR, because all it's going to do is exaggerate all the watery business in the case of non-SBR. And with SBR, it's going to make the SBR sizzle that much more. So the moral of the story there is to only process the highs to keep them controlled and consistent. It's probably not a very good idea to process for aggressive high end in an HEAAC coded stream.
Hey, Greg, I got a question about codecs in general and perceptual audio codecs. And since they're called perceptual audio codecs, they're based on the way we humans hear sound. So does it stand to reason? I've always assumed that I think my assumption has been correct. You tell me if I'm wrong, though, is that if we feed natural audio to a codec, it's going to probably have about the easiest job of turning that audio into a low bit rate and reconstructing it at the other end. But if we hype up the audio in ways that are unnatural, like give it, like you just said, give it extremely high density levels of high end, sounds that you wouldn't hear in nature necessarily, then the codec may have more trouble in doing it. The codec's built for the ear on more natural sounds. Am I kind of right about that?
That is correct. That is very, very correct. But also remember that when these codecs are in the development phase, they're evaluated with lots of ears. They have double-blind testing, which Microsoft never wanted to subscribe to. I wonder why. But all the MPEG family of codecs have always undergone this very rigorous testing phase. But the important part about this to remember is not only are these codecs evaluated with natural sounds, they are also very much evaluated with today's music. Mm. Now, herein lies an interesting rub.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if any, boy, I hate to unturn this stone because this is almost like a separate session in itself. If anybody spent any time at the last AES, oh boy. Kirk, you know, the damage that my company and your company has done in the audio processing department for broadcasting, I am very, very pleased to say that this doesn't hold a candle to what the record companies are doing to their own products today.
Amen. Yeah,
but
I agree with that.
It used to be that Greg Oganowski and Bob Orban and even Frank Foti would get from some of the record people about, oh, you're destroying our mix. Oh, look at what you're doing. Oh, this, oh, that. Well, excuse me, people. It's gotten totally out of control at this point. And with your comment about these perceptual codecs, Kirk, this is where this is very important. The guys doing the codec development are very much using today's CDs. They have to. Their codecs are being used to distribute the music on iTunes, which, as everyone knows, is the world's largest music distribution network in the world at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very important to note that if we touch the stuff with either OptiMod PC, which is our processing domain for streaming and for digital audio, or even Omnia AX, which is Telos's, what those products do aren't anywhere near to what these CDs have already undergone, as it turns out. As a matter of fact, our products are undoing some of the stuff that they've done, and it, in essence, is it's unpeak limiting some of this, which gives the subsequent codec a little bit more breathing room. The unfortunate part that we can never, ever undo is the distortion. Yeah. Once the distortion is in there, you're finished.
Wow. Absolutely true. Can't disagree with that at all. Hey, I want to give Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin an opportunity to ask a question or two that I haven't thought of. And I know we've got more subjects to cover because, Greg, I think you wanted to get into a little bit about the whole stream transport technology and at least give us an introductory lesson as to what these different
stream transports are. I think the introduction would probably be, if we just highlight the bullet points and then maybe, I don't mean to invite myself back, but if you guys would see fit, if you wanted more of this to go into detail, I would be more than happy to do more on this in detail. But, because as I said, you know, every time I do a presentation in front of AES or NAB or whatever, it could literally go on forever. And, there's always a finite amount of time.
Sure. So, regarding what we've talked about so far, Chris Tarr, do you have any follow-up questions for what we've been talking about?
No, but when you get a second, there's an interesting conversation going on in IRC that I would like to address.
Sure. Okay. Mr. Tobin, do you have anything pertaining to what we've talked about so far? Any clarifications?
Just I would agree with the process, you know, the audio going into the codecs. For the encoding, definitely don't overprocess, because I've discovered over the years working with some PDs that, you know, you want everything processed heavily. And I said, gee, the audio just doesn't sound right. This can't be correct. And then over time, I discovered that, yeah, the less process going in, the less craziness with the audio you're doing to it, the better the codecs will process. And you can finesse them with the OptiMod product, which we use on our streams, or the AX, and it does work out. So I agree with Greg. You got to take a different approach. And he's absolutely right, and I can agree and confirm that the music that we're playing, the CDs that we're using for source material, are totally the worst that you could possibly try to work with nowadays compared to, say, 20 years ago.
It's really amazing. I mean, I hate to pick on individual artists and whatnot, but the Bruno Mars CD just showed up here yesterday, and oh, my God, I don't believe this thing. I mean, I can't believe it. And I don't know if any of you guys know who Bill Englott is, but I had lunch with him the other day. Bill has done remastering of just countless numbers of 60s, 70s, and 80s hits. And, you know, he's facing the same dilemma that we are in broadcasting. These guys don't get the work if they don't turn the stuff up to 20 anymore. Mm. And I'm not exactly sure. I guess it's the record execs. But, you know, these guys are playing the same game that we as broadcasters, I can't say we're playing, because I think we're still somewhat playing the same game. But, you know, the reason I say somewhat is because the days of tuning up and down the dial with a manually tuned radio and the psychology that a listener would be more apt to stop at a louder, stronger signal are long since over. They push a button and then they know where the volume control is. The volume control is a control on a radio that every single user knows how to operate, and they know how to operate it very well. So thought should be given very, very seriously as to how far you want to ruin your product before it gets to the input side of that volume control. Because once it's distorted on the input side of the volume control, the listener can't fix it. And unfortunately, the record companies, I believe they're being faced with the same sort of thing. When somebody does a download on iTunes, they want their track to pop on the iPod. They just simply want it to pop on the iPod. And, you know, I was watching the Grammys. I usually watch TV with my laptop in my at my side, not because I'm watching TV on the laptop, but because I always refer to it with what's going on. Okay, so the Grammys are on, and I decide to take a look at what's on the 2011 Grammy nominee CD. And let me tell you about the shape of things to come here, okay? So I go to iTunes, and I see the laundry list of offerings, and I see several of the tracks on there have in parentheses radio edits, and then a couple of them actually said iTunes session.
And yep. That said to you what?
Well, that said to me that apparently that's replacing the radio edits.
Ah, yeah,
that's
okay.
It, exactly.
Okay, gotcha. Not that they had a special session for iTunes, but they had, but that was what was being offered on the CD, the iTunes.
Yeah, yeah, and no, it is a special one. In essence, it's a radio edit, but since radio is unfortunately seemingly being less and less important to them, rather than tagging this thing a radio edit, they opted to tag it as an iTunes session, which more than likely would be a shorter version, probably with 40 dB more compression and clip. It's the clipping. You know, it's the digital clipping. You know, as another side note, I'm working on a technical paper called Zero dBFS Plus, and I'm going to explain how it is entirely possible to go over zero dBFS in digital. Now there's a trick that's really a horrible thought, because this is what's happening with these hyper-compressed CDs.
More of the show, more of our interview with Greg Oganowski coming right up. But first, we're going to take just a moment and hear from our sponsor, which is Axia Audio, for this episode of This Week in Radio Tech. Hey, I want to give you a few actual quotes from engineers who are installing or who have installed Axia live wire-based audio over IP systems. I've been telling you that these systems save you a lot of time and trouble and wire and labor. And then even on down the road, they will save you a lot of time in terms of troubleshooting and making changes, both in audio and in GPIO. Here, let me quote from someone's Facebook page. He says, only a few punch blocks are needed with this AOIP installation. And that's only to distribute the fail points and maximize the I.O. The last one of these studios I built was the traditional way, with tons of trunk cables and probably 40 filled blocks in the rack room. He goes on to say, we now have both stations moved over to the new Axia system. One is in a temporary studio and one is in its permanent studios. Some new photos plus a few choice ones from the old installation. A huge thank you to Axia's Ken Skoke for going well over and beyond what he was there for. Ken was there at that installation, happened to be in the northeast of the U.S., and really helped those engineers to show them how to maximize their use of Axia's technologies and conveniences. Here's a few more quotes from some engineers. Here's an engineer in New York. He says, we saved 60% over traditional wiring methods. Another engineer from a classical station in New York said, saved about 50% of the time and labor versus our previous cabling experience. And Matt Galick at the Metropolitan Opera said about Axia's installation, roughly half the time, actually older methods would not have worked due to tight infrastructure. How about a couple other quotes from people who have actually installed Axia Studios? One engineer says, 2 days per studio, 18 days altogether to install Axia and get it on the air. Another engineer said, Axia is convenient enough to wire yourself. We saved about half. And this is from a location where they usually hire an outside wiring contractor to do the work. And Matt Galick at the Met Opera says, again, we did the Axia wiring ourselves and saved plenty. What about your existing networking, your existing digital or analog system? What are the differences in making, say, configuration changes with Axia IP audio versus other systems? One engineer says, simpler, period. Takes a fraction of the time. Another engineer says, configuration is scalable in a practical way. And another engineer said, graphical user interfaces. The user interfaces to the equipment are absolutely intuitive. So people who have got experience installing Axia audio systems, they will tell you how easy it is, how much time they've saved, how much material and trouble that they've saved over traditional wiring methods. You really owe it to yourself to check out Axia and LiveWire audio over IP. It's easy to do. Just go to the website, type into your browser axiaaudio.com. And there's white papers there. You can read about the equipment. You can read success stories, people who have actually used it. Read about unusual applications like getting your IP audio from one place to another over an IP radio, for example. Or making snakes that are impervious to lightning from one end to the other because they're using fiber to connect a snake, say, underground or between a studio building and a transmitter building. Lots of applications, lots of happy customers, and lots of people using it. And I mean over 2,000 Axia IP Audio Studios are on the air, in use right now today, all around the world. I can't be more proud to work with this company, Axia, and just delighted to help other engineers to understand how this technology works and how to make it work for them. Check it out on the web, axiaaudio.com. We're back, and we're talking with Greg Oganowski on this edition of This Week in Radio Tech. Greg has got a wonderful history of really getting into the nitty-gritty of technology, both in terms of FM modulation and controlling it well. Greg has had a lot of history in tricks and fixes for some very popular equipment in our business to make it work better at the absolute at its maximum performance. And he's been able, of course, to translate that into work for the Orban company to assist Bob Orban and that company with coming up with good algorithms. And Greg's been responsible for a number of innovations there at Orban. And then Greg also is working a lot with audio streaming. In fact, later on in the show, towards the end of the show, Greg's going to tell you about some software offerings that I've got one of them. I think it's a fantastic program. I use it on my iPad all the time. And but right now we're talking about audio processing for streaming, and we've been discussing about what bad things the record industry does to songs. And you know, here, just you know, people used to say this about the broadcaster: "Oh, you're destroying the audio with your audio processing." And I got to tell you, I agree with what Greg said a few minutes ago. I heard him say that you know what we do as broadcasters with audio processing, it ain't nothing compared to the damage done by the people who are mastering records. And if it's the mastering engineers or is it the producers that are whacking them on the hand saying, you need to make this louder. It's got to be louder. It's got to pop off that iPod. It's got to pop off that audio stream. So, Greg, go ahead. You were about to jump into another subject here just before the commercial.
Were you referring to the zero dBFS plus phenomenon, Kirk?
Yeah. Now, look, I mean, I know something about math, and I'm not sure how this is possible, so you got to help me out.
Okay. All right. This. I'm gonna explain a scenario that everyone can test and see this in action for themselves. If anybody has a copy of either Cool Edit or Adobe Audition, that's all you need to see this in action. What you need to do is you need to create yourself a sine wave skewed by 45 degrees at 1/4 the sample rate. So that means if you're at 44.1, this wants to be at 11.025.
Okay.
Now, the reason why you want to skew the manufacture or the synthesis of the sine wave by 45 degrees is so that the start points or where the bits actually show up along the sine wave for reconstruction are skewed.
Sure.
And what will happen is you will find that when you magnify in to the waveform and you actually see where the bits are, you will see that those bits are actually minus 3 dB. But the infamous reconstruction filter that is very vital to the way digital audio works will reconstruct the sine wave at exactly 0 dBFS. Well, here we have the absolute worst case of what can happen. Because it's a pure sine wave, it's only one signal, but this is an absolute worst case to witness what can happen. So let's take that waveform and let's simply normalize it. Now, the normalization process will take those numeric values of those bits and it will take it up to 0 dBFS. It's none the wiser. It's looking at numerical values that are at minus 3 dBFS. It's doing this in the digital domain. It's going to take those numeric values and it's going to do exactly what you're going to tell it to do, and it's going to normalize them and put them at 0 dBFS. Now, what do you think you have when you go to reconstruct this? You've got 3 dB of clipping.
Does that assume that the digital to analog has no headroom?
I'm sorry, one more time, Kirk.
And maybe I'm misunderstanding how a reconstruction process works, including a reconstruction filter. But does that assume that the reconstruction process has no headroom?
That is assuming the reconstruction process had no headroom. That is exactly correct. And many digital to analog converters, as it turns out, do not have adequate headroom.
I didn't know that. So 0 dB full scale digitally is also the top of their analog capability.
That is correct.
Okay.
And this can be, all the details will be explained in this paper that I'm doing. But, you know, you might think, well, of course we're not recording 11 kilohertz sine waves. So how ridiculous could this possibly be? So the best way to figure that out is to do this. Take a CD. Bruno Mars comes to mind. Uh-huh. Rip it. And once you rip it, precisely lower the level by minus 3 dBFS.
Okay, sure.
Since we know that 3 dB is the theoretical maximum that can happen here, we never have to worry about giving it any more headroom than that. 3 dB will be perfectly adequate.
Okay.
So lower it by 3 dB and then simply upsample that to as high as Audition will allow you to do. I believe it's 192.
Okay.
And then you will see that the upsampling is an approximation of the reconstruction process. It's not 100% accurate, but it's damn close enough to prove my point.
Okay.
And then you can zoom into all of this stuff, or even better yet, you can just go to there's a function in Audition that will allow you to do the analysis on the PCM, and it will show you what the highest level is. You will be astounded as to what you find.
You'll find higher peaks than what you started with?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Not yes, but oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Ah, interesting. Hey,
Much to my surprise, I mean, I figured I might see stuff in there like maybe a half to a dB, possibly even a dB, but I'm seeing random stuff go as high as 2.5 to 2.8 dB, and that means
what do you
stuff's
attribute
it's,
that
it's,
to?
It's being pushed, it's being okay. crammed into these crummy D to A's, and that's why a lot of the stuff sounds worse than what you might think it would. Because this is all being done in the digital domain this way. Now, if you had a limiter that worked in the oversampled mode and strictly speaking would not allow this to happen, then you wouldn't end up with these results on these CDs this way. But as it turns out, all of these plugins that all the record people are using to do all this stuff, why it's a problem because none of that stuff's oversampled.
Greg, we're off pretty deep in the weeds right now, and I want to pull back a little bit. Chris Tarr has been monitoring the chat room for the show, the IRC chat room, and Chris, you're noticing a little bit of a confusion there among some of the participants in some of the fundamentals that we're talking about. So, Chris, I'm going to leave it up to you for a moment to kind of explain a couple things, set a couple things straight so we try to all get on the same page here with regard to bit rates and sampling and the other issues you were mentioning.
Sure. Well, I think the first thing to point out is in a perfect world, we could send linear audio over the internet and everyone could receive it and we'd all be happy. But that's not possible. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to limit the amount of data that we're sending to our listeners or viewers or, you know, whatever distribution that you're looking at. And that requires data reduction. And, you know, we had a couple of comments about, well, there's, you know, I have plenty of bandwidth or, you know, bandwidth's cheap or there's lots of bandwidth. But you got to remember that the end users, be it if you're, you know, if you're webcasting, if you're a radio station and you're streaming your station over the internet, your listeners on the other end may not have that much bandwidth. There may be problems with congestion at certain routing points, things like that. You can't control after it leaves your facility where the audio is going to run into, where those bottlenecks are going to be. So, you know, the more you can reduce the data going out to each of your listeners, the better. And if you can do that and make your audio sound decent at the same time, that's a bonus. And so that's why we're looking at things like HEAAC. And one of the comments was, well, you know, it does some funny things to the high end. Yeah, it does. And if you do it right, though, and you process it right, and you start with good quality source material, you limit the amount of damage that's done and the amount of artifacts that you're going to hear. But that's kind of what I wanted to reset is I think there was some question as to why even bother with any sort of really heavy data reduction. You know, you could run it at variable bit rate, you know, MP3, for example, and, you know, have pretty good quality audio. Well, that's great if you're an application where you know that from beginning to end, you're going to have plenty of bandwidth. In the case of broadcasting, where either you're streaming from, you know, maybe your home studio or from your radio station, in that situation, you just don't know who's going to be on the other end and what that path is between you and them. So the more the lower the bit rate you can use, the better. And that's where, you know, things like the HEAAC has come to pass. And why?
You know, that is correct, and everything you say there is spot on. The HEAAC, there is no question that you can sometimes hear funny things on the high end, but consider the alternative. Windows Media, I mean, if that doesn't do funny things to high end, if that doesn't do funny things to the mid-range, there's just no comparison. And likewise with low bitrate MP3. I mean, low bitrate MP3 can be compared to, I don't know, wideband AM to some extent.
I think the question that the chat was dealing with is why are we doing this in the first place? And Greg, you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that the main reason for this is what's the holy grail for people who are streaming audio. It's not you and me sitting in front of our computers and our high bandwidth Xfinity connections. It's the mobile environment. And mobile environment means RF. It means transmission from towers to cell phones, to receivers, to Clear brand or Verizon brand or whatever brand of 3G or 4G data connection. And these are not unlimited. They're not unlimited at all. There's a finite amount of bandwidth that we can shove through the air with the frequency bands that are allocated for doing all this. And if you have 300 people with their wanting to stream audio off of a single cell tower, well, do you want 300 times 32 kilobits per second or 300 times 1 megabit per second? Or if you want uncompressed audio, at least 1.5 megabits per second. So it's just it comes down to, do you want to serve listeners with some pretty good quality entertainment audio and the best we know how to do, or do you want to not serve listeners at all? And I think that's what the choice comes down to. That's why we have to do bitrate reduction. Now, by the way, I worked in the radio automation industry in the mid-90s, back when hard drive space was more expensive than bitrate reducing technology. And so I worked at Scott Studios, and we used APTX at the time as our bitrate reduction technology, because a 9 gigabyte hard drive, something you can buy now for $29, or if, you know, for a thumb drive, a 9 gigabyte hard drive was $1,000. So it was cheaper to bitrate reduce that audio. Nowadays, of course, in terms of storage, it makes no sense to bitrate reduce for storage purposes because storage is so cheap. We can fit thoroughly uncompressed linear surround sound songs on a typical hard drive. You can fit, you know, a 1,000 songs on a typical couple terabyte hard drive. Not a problem at all.
But to get
that through the air to the end user, that's where we have to do the bitrate reduction so we can serve those people.
And that's the great thing about the fact that we have these hard drives available now is, you know, imagine taking something that's been encoded in aptX and trying to, you know, convert it to HEAAC to stream. It would sound awful. So, you know, that's the nice thing is, you know, as time goes by, and unfortunately we can't control the recording side, but on the facility side, on the radio station side, we can make very, very clean and uncompressed. And I'm sure Greg's going into this in a second, which makes it a real good candidate for audio processing for compressing to low bit rates.
Somebody makes the point, yeah, but people are already streaming YouTube 720p HD. Well, remember, 720p HD, that can have a bit rate of 20 megabits per second or 500 kilobits per second. How much quality do you want on your 720p HD? 720p HD in this context is quite a bit different than 720p HD in that context. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And as far as I'm concerned, YouTube has absolutely no place to talk I mean, we've got Bandwidth City at this particular location here, and I have never been able to get YouTube to work reliably here. Personally, I think YouTube is a joke and a bad, bad example of bandwidth. And YouTube is not streaming, by the way. Those are all progressive downloads. The files just deposit to your hard disk, and you can just pull them right out of there. And it all resides on a web server, and the YouTube servers can't even keep up with that.
Gotcha. And we don't know easily where the where other restrictions are in what's going on. Hey, when Netflix got so popular and the ISP started complaining about the extra high asymmetry of data coming in. We like to think of bandwidth as free because it can be pretty cheap, but it's not free. It's not quite free. It does take a lot of infrastructure to get, hey, at my house, if we got two people streaming Netflix films at the same time, two and a half, 3 megabits per second, sure, I'm paying for that. But if half people on my block are doing that, or even 10% of the people in the city of Nashville, Tennessee are doing that, that's a lot of bits.
A lot of people with their consumer internets, they have no idea that they're not getting what they're paying for. I go through it all the time with the providers here, and we even have commercial service. These guys go out and they do these deals on some golf course. They're called peering partners, and one ISP, the way the internet works, I mean, nobody owns conduits from one to the other. And I probably don't have to tell everybody this, but let's go over it. Let's go over it and do a refresher course real quick. The way the internet works is it's all glued together by a whole bunch of different people. And God only knows how many ISPs we're going through to make this happen right here. But this is starting life with Time Warner commercial right now. On this particular leg that we're on, it leaves here and it goes to what is finally a fixed level 3, and this is on a 15 meg pipe. And for a couple of years, they couldn't get this straightened out until I finally went down there and had to give them networking lessons to show them how to get their peering partners configured correctly. But I've got a couple of colo computers up in Fremont, which is about 400 miles from me, and I could never get my 15 meg connection from them. And yet, if I, they would come out here, they'd been out here, they wasted more of my time trying to show me how the 15 meg would work, and yeah, it would work to their first hop. But when it would go to leave downtown L.A., it was finished because it would jump onto level 3. God only knows how it was provisioned or what somebody did to the firmware upgrade and the router over there, but it would leave there, and I couldn't get much more than a very jagged 3 megabits through there. And, consumer internet is even that much worse. These commercials that Verizon and Time Warner are all putting up, about the fastest internet this, the fastest internet that. I go through this all the time. I urge everyone to put a bit meter on their system and to measure exactly what it is they're getting, because I can almost guarantee you're not getting what you're paying for.
And you may be getting it to the local ISP, but you're not getting it through that ISP and on to wherever it's going. And a lot of that is out of that ISP's hands. Now, some of it may be in their hands.
You're absolutely right, Kirk, because that's what happens. Once it leaves the ISP and it goes on to their pairing partner, they don't have anything to do with all of that. And that is the big point of frustration. And then nobody is accountable for any of this. So the only thing you can do is you can bang on your ISP, because the ISP is the one who made the actual agreement with the pairing partner. So it's the ISP who technically is being cheated. But if they did that with some deal with their golf buddy, they're not going to want to look into it. And I know it sounds like I'm on the conspiracy theory end of things, but how deals like this get made?
Yep. Oh, and then somebody in the chat room mentioned, and you do get your 20 megabits per second for 3 seconds with Comcast Boost.
And that is correct. That's the other thing about this. Okay. You'll get your 20 megabits, but can you get a 32 kilobit stream to actually play for more than 5 minutes at a time? Maybe not.
Yeah. Well, we can, here we're doing this thing by Skype, and, I know we all have these frustrations about the way the internet works, And yet, to me, it is pretty amazing that it does work, that these peering agreements do happen. And a lot of times, yeah, there's something that is way less than perfect due to somebody's stupidity or somebody's handshake, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Yeah, we'll say we're doing this, and we both know it really doesn't work that way. But nonetheless, here we are doing a TV show with four people in very diverse locations, all going to a little tiny town in Northern California called Petaluma, and where Burkus is switching it. And, you know, it's mostly working. And that's kind of amazing. We all, as engineers, know it could be better. And we suspect that there are problems along the way, and there are. But still, it's kind of amazing that it works. Hey, let's move back on track. We've got about 5 minutes left in the show. There is so much more that I want to learn from Greg. But I want to give Greg a couple minutes to talk about this software that I've been using called, when I first got it, it was called what, Stream? Tuner 2, and now it's
Stream. Yeah, it was 5. Originally called Tuner 2, and it's now called Streams.
Okay, Streams.
With a big S at the end. And it is software that plays real streams, and it's live streams. And this is it in action. This is, but what makes this different is we really focus on HEAAC streams because that's where the quality is. Like it or not, that's the way it's all gone. You can take this thing, I plug it in my Bose system in my truck, and it will just absolutely blow you away in there with what you can get off of this. It sounds better than any HD radio. It certainly sounds better than satellite radio, and most definitely better than FM radio, no matter whose audio processor on it. I'm sorry to say, FM is what it is, and it always will be what it is. I like to say that we build very very good audio processors to try to get over a lot of the limitations of FM, as does the folks at Omnia. But the fact remains, we're up against a real big problem over there, and that's the receiver manufacturers, because I've got this $3,000 Delphi Bose in that heap of trucks sitting out in the driveway. And I'm here to tell you that it is like 6 dB down at 15 kilohertz because the radio manufacturer couldn't figure out how to get a simple pole correct in the de-emphasis network.
Oh, geez.
And I mean, what do you do with this? You know, and you throw your hands up. I mean, years ago, I set up to try and we did a meeting, which ended up ultimately being the onset of the NRSC. But I called Bob Orban when we were competitors, and I said, pack your bags. We're going to Kokomo. And we had our first meeting with the guys there at Delco Electronics. Also pleased to say that we were the first outsiders to ever get a tour of their silicon wafer plant, which was quite impressive. But apparently the simple arithmetic's a little bit difficult for them. But I understand where they're coming from.
Your AES paper.
They don't want to deal with users that are complaining about noise, such as multipath.
They got a lot of users complaining about different things. They got to make sure those complaints don't happen. Otherwise, somebody's going to return the car or want the radio replaced. Greg, your AES paper, you talked about different software players and their total inadequacies or improper handling of a code of decoding some coded audio. And your Streams software, one of the things that's great about it is that it does this properly. You actually get what the broadcaster intends for you to get. And by the way, it's just gorgeous software. You got a lot of radio stations already pre-programmed into it. And I've got a couple of stations that I'm part owner of. We're streaming in HEAAC V2. And so I've programmed mine in there as well. And they sound awesome on this piece of software. Why does this software sound better than others that we thought were good?
Well, obviously, we were the ones who brought HEAAC to the party a long, long time ago. So I am also pleased to say that we do know a thing or two about it. And by the way, if I could do just a real quick preview, we'll be showing MPEG Surround at NAB, which is sort of the next evolution of all of this. I've got some multi-channel streams up right now, although there are no public players available as of yet. But the cool thing about what we're showing right now is they're 100% stereo compatible. So you can connect them with a stereo player, and they play as 100% mixed down stereo. Yeah. But our streams player for iPhone gets all the HEAAC decoding correct. And if anybody is interested, if you go to streamindex.com, you'll listen to Leo Bark once, and then he'll forward you over to where the Streams app information is. And if you click on the Streaming Hi-Fi Basics and scroll down on the page, there's a plethora of information there about all of this and the various apps. And, you know, of course I'm wanting to sell our app. There's no question about that. But I also had hoped by posting the results of everybody else's app that this would be an opportunity for these people to fix their app, because they're really selling their listeners short here and not giving them what many of the providers are actually sending. I mean,
look at that. Look at that. What's on the screen right now. That's the playback from a competing app.
That's the playback from an improperly configured HEAAC decoder.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the problem here is that many of the software developers that are writing the software don't know anything about digital audio. You know, they're code jockeys. They get an API from wherever. They hear it make noise and they think their job's done, but nobody's actually tested their work.
Mm-hmm. Well, apparently you did, and appreciate that very much. Guys, we are out of time. We got to go, and I think there's no doubt we want to ask Greg back. So, Greg, can I get a commitment for you to come back sometime?
Absolutely.
All right. This has been very educational, and I want to be able to delve into a few more subjects deeply. We got deep in the grass about halfway through the show, and that was a lot of fun, but I know there's other subjects that you want to delve into as well. So thank you so much. Tell us again where that app is found.
It's on the Apple iTunes App Store. Okay. If you do a search, it's under Streams, Streams, space Hi-Fi. And it'll come right up. There's the also an iPad version of it.
Yep, that's what I got.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Hey, Chris Tarr, any last comments about what we've talking about here?
No, I just love listening to Greg talk about this stuff. It's great. And I will tell you, Greg, out on the IRC channel, you've got a lot of fans this evening. So.
Okay, well, thank you, Chris. One other important thing, in case this were to come up, because it just occurred to me that this might be one that would show up over there on IRC. There are certain internet radio appliances that are not decoding HEAAC at all. And when I say at all, I don't mean they don't just play. They're only decoding AAC. So those players are not doing this any justice at all, and they're the players that use the receive a chipset. Those guys apparently don't support HEAAC. Apparently, they haven't gotten the message in 10 years. They're a UK based company. I've tried to get them to go, but hey, it's their business. Whatever. But I am pleased to say that the Logitech family of internet-only radios, they decode it correctly. And by manually putting in the CBS streams to the HEAAC streams, they play in full 16 kilohertz. They literally blow you away. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Speaking of CBS, Mr. Tobin, last comment?
Oh, no, I agree with Chris Tarr. You know, an opportunity to talk with Greg, to listen to him talk about what he's good at, the best at, is a pleasure and an honor, as well as over the years I've read papers, met at the shows, and learned a lot, and along with Bob Orban, a lot of things that all of us take for granted, these gentlemen have done a fine job of pioneering and learning and trying to teach and pass on to others. And as he pointed out, some folks get it, some folks don't. So again, my hat's off to you, Greg.
Thank you, you guys. Thank you very much. And I'd be more than happy to go into the details of the transports, delivering the metadata, all the different packetizations of all of this. If anybody is interested in any of these details, I'd be more than happy to get into it. But we're out of time.
Awesome.
I am just delighted, Greg, to be able to bring you to our listeners. There are a lot of people listening who are craving the kind of information that you're bringing to us. And it's great to interview an expert in the field. So thank you very much for appearing on the show, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you very much, you guys. Thanks a lot.
All right. Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, thank you for being with us. Sure appreciate that. And you people listening, the show is available. The show that you've just heard is available at the website, thisweekinradiotech.com. You can listen to it there. You can download the file there if you like. Also, it's available in the iTunes store. So all you got to do is go to the podcast area, do a search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T, or This Week in Radio Tech, and you'll find it there. You can subscribe to it and get it downloaded automatically to your iTunes software or your iDevice. There's also an RSS feed button on the website. And we have a Facebook page, too, of course, like everybody else. You can like our Facebook page, and you can even listen to the episodes as soon as they're posted right there on the Facebook page. So we appreciate very much your feedback. Oh, and after the show is posted, you can even add to the show notes yourself on the website at thisweekinradiotech.com. Thanks very much to Burke McQuinn back at the Twit Network for switching the show for us. Appreciate it very much. Thanks to Leo Laporte and all the guys at the Twit Network for making this show possible on their network. I appreciate them very much. All right, we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye. This episode of This Week in Radio Tech has been brought to you exclusively by Axia Audio, featuring low-latency live wire audio over IP. It's now in use at over 2,000 radio, TV, and production studios around the world. Get it for yourself. Check it out at axiaaudio.com.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another TWIRT has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny Lopez Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.